Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Neon Ghost Ghost Hour, your pop culture podcast. My name is Benjamin Fiege, and today I welcome a very special guest to the show, Eric Bazilian. Eric is a founding member of The Hooters, the legendary rock band from Philadelphia, which graced us with hits like All You Zombies, Satellite, 500 Miles, or Johnny B. Before the band plays some summer shows in Germany, I talked with him about the band's history, including their famous The Wall and Live Aid performances, and his work for artists like Cyndi Lauper and Joan Osborne. Did you know that Eric wrote Joan's 90s hit One of Us with the Crash Test Dummies in mind? In this episode, he tells us all about it. So, sit back and enjoy the episode. If you like what you hear, subscribe and recommend us to your friends and family, and if not, to your worst enemies.
Neon Ghosts. Ghost Hour. A pop culture podcast.
Hello.
Hello.
Ah, hi. Thank you for your time. You're coming to Speyer here soon?
We are coming to Speyer noch einmal.
Exactly. Special year for you guys. You celebrate 45 years in the business.
Yes.
Is that...
Who would have imagined?
Crazy.
Who would have imagined it?
Is that something you guys could see back then, that it's like a really long-term project? Usually you say like bands have like a lifespan of maybe five, six years. I think it's the average of a band.
I don't know. You know, that's not something anyone thinks about when they're 25 years old, when they're 16 years old. That's not something, you know. Mick Jagger said, you know, maybe he couldn't imagine being 30 years old and being in the Rolling Stones. You know, the Beatles thought that they would have their career for a couple of years and then be songwriters. So, you know, it's not something anyone thinks about. It just happened. And I think we're incredibly thankful that it happened for us and that we're still together in pretty much the original band.
Mm-hmm. You and Rob were like founding members back then. I read that you guys knew each other 10 years already before the Hooters were formed even. Is that maybe like a secret to the longevity of the band, that you guys had like a very stable relationship beforehand already?
Yeah, I mean, we met at university. Actually, my first day at university, I met Rob and joined the band that he had. And then that band broke up, and then we had another band. And we released two albums on a major label, and that didn't work. And then we figured time was going on and we had to make some big decisions about our lives. And we just decided to give it one more go as a band. And that was the Hooters. And 45 years later, here we are.
Where did the name come from back then? Who had the idea? Were there also alternative names discussed?
I will show you.
This is a Hooter.
Oh, okay.
It's a melodica made by, where is the logo? Made by Hohner.
Uh-huh.
And we borrowed one from a friend to use on an early demo. And the sound engineer asked if he could hear that Hooter thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided to call it a Hooter. And then we decided to name the band after it.
So it had nothing to do with the restaurant.
No, we came first. The restaurants came a few years later.
Okay. I read that you guys started out in Philadelphia, yeah, and you were pretty successful in that area, but it took some years to have that nationwide breakthrough.
Yeah, it took 5 years, which is about how long it takes. I mean, it took the Beatles, John Lennon and Paul McCartney met in 1958. They had their first single in 1962, First real success in 1963, and then the US in 64. So it took them 5 years.
What kept you guys going in the meantime? Did you could you already live from the music, from the gigs and stuff, or did you all had like secondary side jobs, or was that difficult back then?
Often, and we barely lived from the music, but we lived well enough. We had a van that we all climbed into to travel and do our gigs. We had food and we had beer.
That's enough, exactly. And then that huge success from a German perspective, what really we already had an interview a few years ago. We talked about like your big hits and stuff. What we didn't talk about back then, what I found very interesting, those like you guys participated in that 1990 The Wall concert in Berlin, especially now from a German perspective, of course, very interesting. How did you guys end up taking part there? You knew Roger Waters before, I think, yeah?
Yeah, Roger Waters was a fan. He came to one of our shows in London and stuck around afterwards, introduced himself, and a couple of years later, the Wall concert happened, and I believe we were in Tokyo, we were in Japan, and he called to ask if we could be in Berlin in 5 days.
And were you guys directly on board, or did he have to like convince you?
No, directly. We had to fly home first. We thought about going directly to Berlin from Tokyo, but that didn't work. So it was a real whirlwind of a trip, but it was amazing. And Roger was very, very kind to us, very gracious, and it was really an inspiration to be around him during that time. There was so much going on, so much that could have gone wrong, and whenever anything came up, any kind of problems, any kind of complications, he just took a deep breath and fixed it.
Did you like were there any rehearsals or something? You said like 5 days before the concert. Like how much time to prepare the show did you guys have back
There were
then?
two or 3 days. I remember when we got there, when we walked into the hotel where all this was happening, he was rehearsing with Bryan Adams, and we had toured with Bryan Adams, so it was nice to run into him there. I think then he rehearsed with Ute Lemper, who we had met. She had come to a couple of our shows before, and of course we knew Cyndi Lauper. But then it was amazing, just the superstars, not just musicians, but movie stars and just people that we'd seen on TV and in films, and there they are hanging around backstage, being stupid people just like we are.
So, do you guys, when you say like all these big names, you guys were also stars back then already? Like, did you still feel starstruck by some people
I still
yourself?
feel starstruck by some people. Absolutely. I hope they are too. No, we felt like we belonged there. We absolutely felt like it was our time, our place.
Was it directly clear which song you would perform when he asked you guys, or was that something that was discussed when you arrived? Okay, you guys do this, you guys do this.
Well, originally he just asked us to do a set before the show. So we really didn't know we were going to be in the actual Wall production. But then he said, I have an idea. How about at the big beginning of the show, some stormtroopers, at the beginning of the show, you will walk up the ramp towards the stage and some stormtroopers will run, pick you up and carry you off. And we said, okay. And then at the end of the show, he came up to us and he said, you see that scaffold over there, 30 meters high? Can you climb up to the top of that and wave to the audience from there? So we did. And then we looked across the stage, and on the other scaffold was the Scorpions, who I got to be friends with years later. I ended up writing a whole lot of songs with them. But that was an amazing experience climbing up to the top of that and looking out over the audience to see what 300,000 people looked like.
Were you guys political people back then? Like the whole context of it, was that something you guys cared for, read into, followed
Well,
in terms, or?
everyone is political in their way. As a band, we're not, we don't have a band message. We all have our own opinions, but there was nothing in that concert that you could argue with. The point of that was to raise money for a good cause, to create a trust that would endure for generations and help a lot of people. Same as Live Aid. How could you argue with feeding starving people in Ethiopia? That's just common human sense.
Good bridge to my next question. Live Aid was the other big thing, and for you was also like in Germany we say Heimspiel, game on your home ground.
Ja, wir waren zu Hause in Philadelphia mit unseren Freunden.
Exactly. How was that? Were you guys nervous before?
I don't think we were nervous. We didn't have time to be nervous. We showed up very early in the morning, and then at 9 o'clock, someone said, "Get on that elevator, put your instruments on, get on that elevator." The elevator went up to the stage. We walked out and looked at 100,000 people. We plugged into amplifiers that we'd never played through before because we didn't have a sound check,
Okay.
and we went right into and we danced and All You Zombies, and then it was over. It was 10 minutes. It was all a blur.
No time to think about it.
No
Maybe.
time to think about it.
Usually, like a thing for you guys, stage fright, is that something you deal with as?
Not for me. No, I don't get stage fright. At least not for in big shows. Sometimes if I'm doing a solo gig for 50 people, I'll get nervous. That's different. But I use that nervous energy to create something spontaneous. My solo shows are very different from Hooters shows. Hooters shows are very, we have a set list. Everything goes like clockwork, although there's a lot of spontaneity that happens in that. Crazy things happen between us and the audience. But when I do a solo show, it's really just improvisation. I have an idea what songs I'm going to do, but anything can happen. I can start singing and All You Zombies, and suddenly I'm singing La Vie en Rose.
Why would you think you'll feel a bit more nervous maybe in a solo show? Because all the responsibility is on you, while in a band, maybe someone can help you out or.
I think it's just because I don't do it that often.
The routine.
And I like that. I like the fact that I don't know what's going to happen. I think the audience does too. It's a very different way of connecting with people, but it seems to work very well.
What was the worst thing that ever happened to you on stage? Something comes to mind?
Any band will tell you about times when the PA system blew up. When it started raining or snowing on an open air gig. But those are just inconveniences. Nothing really bad has ever happened to us on stage. I mean, it's a shame when the PA system blows up during the first song and you have to cancel the gig. And that has happened a couple of times, but for the most part, it's been smooth sailing on stage for us.
Just recently talked to Nick Kershaw, who also was part of Live Aid, and he said like he forgot the lyrics of his most famous song on that day in that concert. Like
If you're going to forget the lyrics to your most favorite song, that's probably when it's going to happen. I mean, yes, we've all done embarrassing things on stage.
But you recover.
We do recover. So far, we've always recovered. We'll see what happens this summer.
What I found also very interesting reading your biography, before you guys had your mainstream breakthrough, you already were writing songs for other artists, most notably, of course, Cyndi Lauper. How did you guys get in touch with her? How did you guys end up in that role?
When I first met Rob, he was in a band that had a drummer named Rick Chertoff, who that's the band that I joined. It was called Wax, and then the band broke up, and Rick, the drummer, decided that he didn't want to be a drummer anymore, that he wanted to be a record producer and work for a record company picking songs for artists. And in 1983, 1982, he got a gig producing an album for a new artist named Cyndi Lauper. And he decided that rather than having studio musicians in New York, he would build the whole arrangement of the album around Rob and I. So we were the band on that album. We spent 6 months in our little rehearsal studio in Philadelphia with my four-track cassette recorder, making demos of the songs that Rick had found. During the recording of that album, Rob and Cyndi wrote Time After Time.
Did you guys already back then feel like, oh, that woman is gonna make it
We,
faster?
when we first met her, it was undeniable that she was one of a kind. Even before we heard her sing, her personality and the way she looked was like no one else. And then when she opened her mouth and started singing, it was just wow. The album was very very unusual, and I admit when we finished it, we really didn't know if it was going to be successful. I knew that Time After Time was a timeless hit, pun not intended, but I knew that it was a song that we were going to be hearing for the rest of our lives. But girls just want to have fun. It was such a wacky song with such a crazy, quirky arrangement. We had no idea whether the world was going to love it or hate it. And I think probably it was both, but definitely the love more than the hate.
What happened after that album was such a huge success? Did you guys get a lot of offers to also write for other contemporary artists or?
You would think that we would have, but not so much right away. We really focused on being the Hooters. We took a break from performing during that while we were making that record with Cyndi, and then we decided it was time to start up again, and we just continued. And then a few months later, we made an independent album, because even after making the Cyndi Lauper album, the record companies in New York weren't coming down to Philadelphia to see us and weren't really interested in what we were doing. So we made an album all by ourselves, a little independent album called Amore, and we sold 150,000 of those just around here. And that finally made the record companies wake up and see that there was something going on. And Rick Chertoff, who was working for Columbia Records, did sign us. And then the result of that was, Nervous Night, and then One Way Home, which had Johnny B on it, and Zigzag with 500 Miles.
Maybe it's like asking a parent what's their favorite child, but from all the songs you wrote, do you have like a favorite? Or I asked Russ Ballard recently the same question. He says it's always my last. That's the one I wrote.
I used to feel that way. And now I feel like it's my oldest, really. And it's kind of of the Hooters songs, I'd probably say All You Zombies, just because it was the first song that we wrote that lasted, and because we had no idea that it was going to have the life that it's had. We really thought it was a weird song, a crazy Bible story that no one was going to care about. And then, the other song that I've written that I'm definitely the most attached to and proud of is One of Us, because, it's a song that I think everyone in the world knows, even though most people don't know that I wrote it, and I'm fine with that.
One of us is it true that you got that you wrote that song with the crash test dummies in mind first?
I didn't have them in mind, but I did have Brad Roberts' voice in my head. So, on my original demo, the demo that I played for Joan and Rick and Rob, I actually sang the opening lines like him. I sang it like, "If God had a name." And if you go on Spotify or Apple Music and look for my solo album, my first solo album called The Optimist, play the last track and wait 30 seconds, you can hear my original demo of the song.
So it never reached them.
It did actually. Well, in interviews, I would talk about the fact that, that he did inspire it to some extent. And I ran into him at one of their shows a few months later, and he thanked me for naming him. And I said, well, thank you for, putting your voice into my head. And if you really want to thank me, come over to my house and let me record you singing it. So I actually have an amazing recording of Brad Roberts from the Crash Test Dummies singing One of Us. And someday the world needs to hear it because it really is very, very unique.
I can imagine. I love the Crash Test Dummies too. Must have been the time when they just released God Shuffled His Feet, so it would have also been in line a bit, yeah,
Oh, definitely. That's, they were everywhere then. And I was a fan from the beginning, from their first album, and I'd seen them a few times and met them, and they were already in my brain.
I definitely want to hear that version one day for sure. It's super cool. I always wonder when guys like you wrote for so many other big names, also Billy Idol, Jon Bon Jovi, all those people. When do you know, okay, that is a song I want to give to someone else, and this is a song I want to record myself, or that's a Hooters song? Is there a rule of thumb somehow?
If I write a song with an artist, then it's their song. It's, one of the songs that I wrote with Bon Jovi, I wrote for Bon Jovi. Same with the Scorpions, same with Billy Idol. Hooters songs are songs that Rob and I write together, and Hooters songs have a special quality to them. We know when it's a Hooters song, we know when it's not a Hooters song. Most of the songs that I write on my own are very, to me, they're wonderful songs. They're very personal, and I think they're all great, but most of them aren't Hooters songs. Hooters songs have a special perspective and a special sound, and it's something that Rob and I create together.
When you just said, like, when I asked you what is your favorite song, you said maybe my oldest. Is that the reason why your guys' latest album has a bit of like a back to the roots sound to it?
Yes, well, for a long time we talked about going back to our ska and reggae roots because it's something that we hadn't done in a very long time. And it's interesting because our German audience doesn't know that part of our history so much. For Germany, our career began with Johnny B. And then going back, they discovered All You Zombies and We Danced, etc. But so we thought it would be interesting for our fans in Germany to hear where we started, and it was exciting for our fans in the US, especially in Philadelphia, to hear us go back to that. But it took a long time. We had moved on from that time in our lives, and that inspiration. It really took going back and finding old cassettes, especially old four-track demo cassettes, and finding songs that weren't finished, and actually taking the recordings that we made in the 80s. They go back as far as 1982, putting them into the digital world and creating a band around them. So it was sort of a step back and a step forward. We have a new single that was released today, actually.
Oh, okay.
It's called Pendulum, and it's based on a song that we wrote in 1995 and actually did perform in Germany. It was a very different song then, and it's a very, very timely song now. Pendulum is a word that you hear a lot now in the news, but the politically, socially, how the pendulum swings from left to right, back and forth. The song is about that, and it's more of the folky, rocky Hooters sound that our fans are accustomed to, and it's an anthem. I think it's going to be great live, and I think a lot of people are going to enjoy it very much.
There was quite a long time without a new regular Hooters album before. Is that now something you guys want to pursue more again, releasing albums, singles?
We'll see. We have a lot of songs already, and we perform most of them. And the rule for us is if we're going to write a new song and go through the take the time, and it does take time, it doesn't get easier. But if we're going to do that, it has to be a song that lives next to Johnny B, that lives next to All You Zombies, that li lives next to Satellite, Carly with a K, 500 Miles. It has to be a song that we will play in our show, and the audience won't go and get another beer while we're playing it.
So I hear that from a lot of artists that with age somehow one becomes a bit more picky when it comes to their own stuff, while back in the early days of the career one is pushing out, and is that
Well,
something you feel?
the bar is very high. You know, again, if we're going to write another rock song, it needs to live with And We Danced and Day by Day. If we're going to write another reggae, it has to live with All You Zombies or 500 Miles. If we're going to write another heavy rocker, it's got to live with Johnny B and Satellite. So, you know, it's something special has to happen. Now, our new song, Pendulum, is different. It's more like an Irish drinking song, and we don't have one of those. On our last album, on Rocking and Swing, we had Why Won't You Call Me Back, which was a real up-tempo ska, which we'd never had a hit song like that before. So, you know, everything has to have something new, but at the same time, it has to fit in with the world that we've created.
What makes a good song for you? Do you have like a definition for yourself? What is the key to a successful song?
A good melody, a good lyric, and a great guitar riff.
Mean, when you talk to songwriters nowadays, it's often TikTok plays a role when they try to create a song. Conceptualize it, it has to be TikTok friendly.
Yeah, we don't do that.
Yeah.
No, we just don't do that.
For you guys, was the radio like a similar medium where you try to make it very radio friendly, or did you guys completely blank that out, like all those rules that go for like a good radio song?
We blanked it out. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you know, going back to All You Zombies, you know, which was a song we wrote in 1980, and we didn't think anyone was ever going to care about. The first thing that happened with that song was in 1981, we played it on a live radio broadcast in Philadelphia, and the radio station WMMR, which was in still a huge rock station, they started playing it. They started playing it every day. We released a live single. You know, we put it on the Amore album, and again, that started getting airplay. When we made the Nervous Night album in 1985, we made the song 6 minutes long, which we never thought was something that would go on the radio. But when we went to master the song, we went to our mastering session. The mastering engineer, George Marino, who was a legend, he had mastered all the great rock records up until then. We asked him what he thought the first single should be, and he said, All You Zombies, obviously. And of course, we edited it down. We took it down to 4 minutes, but that's a song that just keeps, it won't go away. It won't go away. And, you know, that song has a strong melody, it has a strong message, and yes, a great guitar riff and a great keyboard riff. I'll give credit to Rob for that one.
So at a certain point, you know, okay, I think we or I have a hit here. I read that when you first heard Joan Osborne's demo of One of Us, you already practiced your Grammy
My
acceptance.
granny, the speech that I didn't get to give. Yes, that's I knew that when I heard her voice singing that song, I knew, we all knew. Same thing with Cindy, when we heard Cindy singing Time After Time. Actually the first time Rob and Cindy played it for me just on the piano, I knew that that was a classic. I think And We Danced, we knew that that song had a real shot at getting on the radio.
Is it different for you if you write a song for a female or male artist? Or do you write songs usually that can be sung? I mean, one of us can be sung by a male or a female, just
Sure.
doesn't matter in that sense. But in general, is it something
It depends. Again, if I'm writing with a female artist, it's usually from a female perspective. One of us, I didn't write One of Us for Jonah. That I just wrote that. That as a song that literally just appeared in the middle of the night to impress my new girlfriend, who's, my wife since then.
when you say like you write for someone, is it usually, I mean, I saw that on the credits of many of your songs, like sometimes you're named as like a co-author. Is that something that's like a business thing where basically it was you who wrote the song, but the artist you wrote it for somehow ends up in the credits? I know Elvis did that a lot.
Yeah, no, that's only happened once with a mega star, and I'm not going to name names, but no, usually it's a song that I start and finish with the artist.
And can you tell maybe an anecdote? Who was the easiest or the hardest to collab?
I won't talk about the hardest. Amanda Marshall is one that really that I always think about. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she came to me in 1997, and she was coming off a huge album, that her first album, and
Let it rain and
yes, ex yeah, of course, and I was still riding high on One of Us, and I thought, well, I'll meet her, but I'm just going to write a great song for her. She hadn't written most of the songs on that first album, but as soon as we met, I knew that she had the potential to be an amazing writer. And the first song came easily, the second song came easier. We really had an amazing chemistry, as friends and as collaborators. And we haven't done anything since that album, but we stay in touch
Oh,
every few months. I'll call her, she'll call me.
maybe there's opportunity in the future again. I think she just gave her comeback last year with like an
Yeah,
EP.
she did. It was great. Well, we'll see. If she lives in her world, I live in mine. When all that started, the Hooters weren't really active at that point, so I had a lot more time to do outside projects. Now I'm a Hooter full time. Even when we're not touring, it's still the thing in the front of my mind.
Is it still something you guys enjoy touring?
Love it. We absolutely love it. We'll keep doing it until we can't. As soon as there's so much work that goes into preparing for a tour. But we have an expression, butts in seats. Once we get our butts on the seats in the airplane, it's all smooth sailing, especially in Germany. We get to Germany, we've got our amazing tour manager, Holger, who takes care of everything. He fights our battles for us. We get on the bus and we show up at the gig. Maybe we have a sound check, maybe we don't. We have dinner. We go on stage, we have an amazing time for 2 hours, hang around for a little while afterwards, go to the hotel, get on the bus, and start over again.
And the shows are great. I saw you guys perform a few years ago. It was before the pandemic in Neuleiningen, like a wine.
Yes, oh yes. We love playing at the wineries and
The was
Schlossgarten.
yeah, like a nice castle. Was very, very cool. Was very cool. In an interview, you mentioned that for some reason it seemed like the German fans were a bit more loyal than the American fans.
Yes, I mean, aside from Philadelphia, our fans in Philadelphia are always there for us. But for whatever reason, most of America forgot about us. It's funny, they still remember the old hits, but most of our fans don't know that we put out another record after Nervous Night. When we play Johnny B in the United States, it's when we play Johnny B in Germany, it's
Is that something you have an explanation for? Is it like the same that happened with so many rock bands when the 80s transitioned into the 90s and suddenly there was grunge and all that stuff? Or
I don't think so, because that was all happened in the 80s. Johnny B came out in 87. Who knows? Maybe it was it, maybe it came out at the wrong time. Maybe the record company didn't promote it well enough in the United States, but the German label did. On the other hand, All You Zombies and We Danced never really were hits in Germany. So, and they were number one in Australia, and nothing else ever happened in Australia. So a lot of it has to do with timing. A lot of it has to do with MTV. MTV was such an important force in the 80s. And when we put out Nervous Night, they loved us. And We Danced was a huge video. They were all top five videos on MTV.
Yeah, but we are happy to see you now here in Speyer soon. Can you tell us what you guys have in store for that concert?
Well, you'll hear the hits, of course, and you'll hear the new single. Of course, we'll be playing Pendulum, and hopefully people will check it out. It's on all the streaming services. You can download it on iTunes, and there's also a new live album coming that we just finished from the Keswick Theater in Philadelphia. 2 hours of music. But there's always surprises. We're always finding new inspiration in the songs, new arrangements, different set lists. Even though the set, once we find the set, it usually is the same, but there are always surprises that happen during the show. We surprise ourselves.
Songs from the new album you guys include also in the
Of course. Yes, about half of the album.
Awesome. Okay, yeah, we look forward. Thank you very much. Okay.
Okay.
I hope to catch you in Speyer.
Please, of course.
Then I good luck and good travels then.
Thanks, and let us know if you're coming to Speyer.
I will.
We can
Okay.
say hello. Okay.
Awesome. Thank
Vielen
you.
Dank. Tschüss.
Tschüss.
And now a message from our sponsors.
The world talks about Africa, but when you want real insights, it crickets. That's why we built Raw Academy. Access in-depth insights from Africa's top entrepreneurs, investors, and industry leaders. Not just headlines, but real strategies, real opportunities. Discover high-growth sectors, navigate emerging markets, and learn the nuances that drive success. At Raw, we give you the tools to make decisions that are smart, strategic, and profitable. From tech and startups to agriculture and energy, we connect you to Africa's most promising sectors. This isn't about charity, it's about opportunity. Business leaders, investors, and entrepreneurs, it's time to take action. Visit the Raw website at resources.raw.academy. Gain the knowledge, make the move, and own the future.